Blog Talk Radio.
Military Monday on the Rightstream Radio Network. I am your host, John Gresham, and we are going to be talking about a very interesting book today. Now, we have book authors and talk about books on this show all the time because these are the people who really understand the subject matter they're writing about. But in this particular case, this is not a book in the traditional definition. This book wasn't really written. It was kept. It was, if you will, a diary of sorts. It was not modest in length. It has around 4,000 pages to it. And it was, for many years, a highly classified document, only released to the public for limited viewing late after World War II. But this book has had an interesting year. And to talk about this book, we're going to bring on a couple of people, I think, who you're going to enjoy a great deal. Mr. Al Nofi, who is the one of the editors of the well-known Strategy Page website, and Dr. Alan Benson. Al Nofi knows about as much about the Pacific War and the people who ran it as anybody you're going to run into. And Dr. Benson, who is a librarian and curator up at the Naval War College, was involved in the preservation of this document. What we are going to talk about is we are going to talk about the so-called gray book that was kept by the staff of Fleet Admiral Chester Nimitz, the Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet, during World War II. And let us introduce our guest. Al Nofi, are you there?
Yes, I guess I am.
And Dr. Benson, are you with us?
I'm here also.
Al, I'm going to start with you and say, introduce yourself to the listeners and tell them a little bit about yourself and why the Pacific War is of interest to you.
Oh, that's a long and complicated story.
Answer, 50 words or less in 22 seconds.
Okay. You know, growing up, I was born in 44, everyone around as a child was a veteran. And my uncles were all in the service. My father was 4F, but his four brothers and his brother-in-law were all there, and only one of them was not forward. So we got a lot of war stories, and in fact, I even had pieces of my uncle's uniforms hanging around, and so that piqued my interest in particularly naval history. And I eventually I went to college. I became a secondary school teacher, and I spent almost 30 years in alternative education, and mostly in Harlem and East Harlem in New York. At the same time as I was pursuing my interest in naval history, and ended up with a doctorate in military history, actually. So that's where I sort of came from into this. And as you noted, I had worked, after I retired from teaching, I was hired by Center for Naval Analyses, and a wonderful job because they sent me to be a staff member and advisor and whatnot at an institute that is co-located with the Naval War College, which sort of looks to the future of the Navy. And that is what got me interested in what became the subject of my 2010 book, the Navy's maneuvers, fleet maneuvers during the period between the wars, when they worked out pretty much all of the problems that they were to encounter in the war against Japan, including the, and if they had paid attention, they would have caught the kamikaze problem too, which we'll talk about later, I guess. I started looking for material on it, and it turned out they had this mother load of stuff there, and then that they had other material, of course, available on microfilm from the National Archives and from other resources. So that book grew out of that, and it's interesting that Nimitz, even though he was, for most of the period between the wars, a relatively low-ranking person, keeps cropping up in interesting ways, and we'll presumably get into that as well.
We will in a couple of minutes. Dr. Benson, you are a librarian. You are a preservationist. You are a curator. You have worked on some interesting projects. Tell us a little about yourself, please.
Well, what drew me to this particular project and my interest in general is to help individuals like you and Dr. Nofi gain more access to more information. And this was another problem of how do you take a document that's pretty restricted because it's a physical object you have to be in proximity with to use. How do we make it more accessible to a broader audience? And that drew my interest to this project. It was a significant top secret document, previously top secret, and it went through different iterations once it became public, but it was still had quite limited access. So my general interest here was the challenge of how do you make a document like this buried deep within the archives at the Naval History and Heritage Command, how do you make it accessible to more people?
And we're going to talk a lot about that here as we move along. But let's start with you, Al. You just mentioned that throughout your studies for your book on the fleet problems, this young officer who had a growing career path pops up a lot.
Yeah.
Chester Nimitz. Who was he? What was he? And why does he become the subject of so much interest these days?
Well, who was he is interesting in a way, and in fact even how he got into the Navy is kind of interesting. He was born in Fredericksburg, Texas, which is part of the old German country, which is still considerably German. It was settled mostly by Germans before the Civil War. They tended not to be Confederate sympathizers, but...
Not a lot of oceans around Fredericksburg, Texas, though.
Yeah, but his grandfather was an old sea captain, and they built a hotel in Fredericksburg. And actually, if you look at it carefully, there's sort of a balcony there that looks like a ship's bridge. Now, I had for many years thought that the reason that Nimitz decided to go to sea was, you know, if you're growing up in the middle of Fredericksburg, Texas, you probably want to, you know, you might want a change of scene. Well, it turns out that he originally wanted to go to West Point, and which was a big surprise to me, you know. But there were no slots. You know, when he applied to his member of Congress, the guy told him that the slots available for Texans were gone, but that there was a slot at the Naval Academy. So he entered the Naval Academy in 1901, and this, of course, is a heady time in the Navy. This is we're in the aftermath of the Spanish-American War, and the Navy has apparently performed gloriously. The flaws, of course, were overlooked. And he graduates in 1905, and he goes to sea, of course, in a battleship, because that's what you did in those days. And then he goes to other kinds of sea duty. In those days, you spent an incredible amount of time at sea. You learned to work at sea. He even ran a destroyer aground.
And was court-martialed for it, amazingly enough.
Yeah. And was given a letter of reprimand. Now, you understand that today you'd be out of the Navy for doing that, because in those days, if you ran a destroyer aground, basically, you know, you hauled the ship out, you hit it with a hammer a few times to get the dents out, and you put it back in the sea. Today, of course, running a ship aground means that all that glorious electronic stuff hanging from the bottom – has just been pulverized, and you're into Uncle Sam for a couple of tens of millions of dollars. So there is a difference.
Well, there's also a cultural difference that it was expected that young officers would take their ships into harm's way, and occasionally they would bump into things.
Yeah, and ships were cheap, you know, compared to today. And he was an ensign. I mean, you know. Now, he early got into submarines, and this was kind of interesting because in those days, American submarines were gasoline-powered on the surface. Can you imagine going to, you know, having a gasoline engine with all that flammable gas around and stuff, you know. By 1912, he was actually in command of the Navy's Atlantic Fleet submarine flotilla. Now, there's only like a couple of dozen boats, you know.
That's a pretty good job for a young junior officer.
Yeah, he was probably then probably only a JG by then, and he was performing well as a young officer. He even got a life-saving medal for saving a sailor from who fell overboard, and you know, he was one of the first people to introduce the diesel engine to the Navy,
and he paid a price for this—a personal, a very hard personal price.
Yeah, he lost a finger.
Literally got a finger caught in the gears, and would have lost another one but for his class ring.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, one of the things that's interesting is, of course, that in the Second World War, he's running the war against another guy who's lost a finger. In fact, two fingers, I think. Yamamoto had lost a finger at the Battle of Tsushima, two fingers, as a junior officer. So the funny kind of connectivity between the two men, you know. But one of the things that's interesting is that the ship that he installed the first diesel engine on was the Maumee, which was a tanker. And this tanker is going to have an interesting effect on his career later. Anyway, he went to Germany. He actually spoke German. I don't know whether he was actually raised by his grandfather. His father died, I think, even before he was born. So he did speak German. And so since he had already done some work in diesel engines, the Navy shipped them to Germany, and he studied diesel engines in Germany and some other places in Europe, came back to the U.S., and became the chief engineer and executive officer of the same ship, the Maumee, right?
Right.
She's in commission. Now, what's important about the Maumee is that she was let me check my notes here. It's always good to she was the first first tanker in the fleet, and the problem and people were already trying to figure out how do we refuel at sea. They'd already tried how do we coal at sea, and this is that was like a horror. I mean, coaling under any circumstances was a horror, you know. But they built the, what the heck was it called, the Jupiter class or whatever, of
the
colliers. They had the four ships, they had this elaborate superstructure with cranes and stuff that could coal a ship at sea, and not just, you know, I mean, in a calm sea, of course, but not just in some sheltered cove, you know. As it turns out, three of the ships were lost to accidents, and the fourth one became the Langley. They probably were lost to accidents because of this ridiculous superstructure, you know, because with coal, if the ship is rolling too much and you're careless about balancing your load and whatnot, you could lose your ship. And all three ships literally were lost, and of course one of them is lost in the so-called Bermuda Triangle, so all the woo-woo people are out there, you know, always talking about it. But the fact that the other two ships were lost in various parts of the ocean, you know, doesn't come into the equation. So anyway, the skipper of the Maumee was interested in developing a way to refuel ships at sea, you know, re-oil at sea. And it becomes interesting because he is one of the people who's writing technical papers. In fact, I think one of his first published technical papers is about refueling at sea, which is, you know, kind of interesting.
So you have this young officer who's going through all the good wickets in the Navy.
Yeah.
He goes to the War
yeah.
College, spends time at Newport. He starts commanding bigger ships, including eventually a battleship. And
yeah,
then
Go
ahead.
To carry on from that, the thing is that's interesting about it is he has a lot of bites. You know, the Navy didn't have communities in those days. Everybody was just a naval officer. And you actually got guys, for example, who are aviation qualified, who command a destroyer, and their next assignment is commanding a squadron, which would never happen today, of course. You know, now, I understand that there's a lot of technical differences and whatnot. But these guys perhaps understood the tools available to the Navy better than most. And there certainly
was a definite cross-pollination, as you say, in terms of the expertise of other people's tools, tactics,
yeah.
and practices.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things about him, in 1939, now, you know, between the wars, we're getting the fleet problems, right? And one of the big problems of battles, the Navy's had maneuvers for decades, but of course there are no maneuvers during the First World War, and they resume after the First World War. And the big issue is, why did the Battle of Jutland not prove decisive? You know, I mean, why didn't the British just overwhelm the Germans? And of course the issue was, how do you deploy a large fleet of battleships? I mean, at Jutland the Brits had, what, nearly 40 battleships or something? You know, how do you get these guys into formation so that they can slug it out with the other guys? And so this was one of the main problems that was coming up in for testing during the fleet problems. And Nimitz again is involved, a fellow officer who's sort of forgotten to history. His name is Roscoe McFall. Developed a circular cruising pattern. In a way, it's almost like the old way that Napoleon would move an army. You know, he'd have like an army corps on each flank, and he'd have one in front and one in the rear and then the reserve in the center, so that if the enemy showed up at any side, you could begin to deploy the army in that direction. And you would always have a center and a left and a right and a rear and a reserve. And so McCaskill's cruising formation put the ships into parallel lines surrounded by belts of cruisers and destroyers, and then further out, more cruisers to scout for the enemy. And the idea was that whatever direction the enemy showed up in, some of the ships would be closest, and they would then become the vanguard of the fleet, and the others would fall in behind them. And this was actually practiced over and over again, and of course it's still used today, although of course since a force goes to sea today, it relatively speaking, it's a small number of ships. In those days when it went to sea, it was the whole fleet going at once, so you'd have 18 or odd battleships, you know, plus dozens of destroyers and actually a handful of cruisers, since Uncle Sam didn't build cruisers in those days. So that was one of the things that he kept pushing in the fleet. And he does this through his entire career as he rises to higher and higher rank. He's constantly shifting back and forth, from these technical assignments to these staff assignments, and he's learning the other trade. Now, he was never, of course, an aviator. Although being a technically inclined guy, I suspect he at least was following the literature. He does have an interesting experience in 1939. 1939 was, I guess it was the largest maneuvers the fleet held between the wars. They were held in the Caribbean. And despite, well, like today, whenever the fleet has maneuvers or a cruise is scheduled, someone immediately connects it to a political crisis that's unfolding now, one that I think's been in preparation for months or years even, right? You know. And but in that case, in 1939, it was the maneuvers were decidedly intended to send a message to Hitler and Mussolini. They were held in the Caribbean, and if you look at it carefully, you realize that it's a Spanish Civil War scenario. And what Uncle Sam is saying to these guys is, if you mess in one of these little, you know, one of these Latin American countries, and think you're going to do what you did in Spain, you got a problem because the U.S. Navy is going to be there. But you have a problem in the Pacific. You can't put the whole fleet in the Caribbean and leave the Pacific totally naked. So who do they pick to command the small force that remains in the Pacific? Nimitz. They give him the Arizona, the Saratoga, and some cruisers and destroyers. And they're maintaining the fleet's presence in the Pacific. They're also doing other things. They're working out task force formations. In those days, remember, the battleship is still the core of the fleet, so that when the fleet is cruising with the carriers in the fleet, if it comes time to launch aircraft, the carriers essentially leave the formation. And then take care of their business and then return to the formation. Well, what Nimitz is doing is one of these guys, he's adapting the battle, you know, the fleet cruising formation so that the whole fleet takes its cue from the carriers rather than the battleships, which is kind of interesting. They're
certainly
also doing
ahead of the time. And
yes.
And at that point, he winds up getting put into something called the Bureau of Navigation.
Yes.
Not a very impressive sounding title, which is where he was on the day Pearl Harbor happened, as director of the Bureau of Navigation.
Yeah, that's basically the Navy's personnel department.
And he knew everybody in the Navy that was anybody.
Yes, and this is going to pay off later, because when the time comes to pick up people for assignments, he doesn't just have these papers in front of him. He has probably met the guy, especially if the guy's a flag. And he knows how the guy reacts under pressure. He knows that the guy has to be kept on a short leash or can be given a long leash. You know, some of the guys drank too much. Some of the guys chased women too much. They might be good for their trade, but it would be embarrassing if, on a particular moment, the guy is had a little too much to drink. You know, he might be perfectly capable sober or even super capable sober. So this is one of the reasons why he had a lot of confidence in people. When he took over from Kimmel at Pearl Harbor, now he arrives only 8 or 10 days after the attack. And the first thing, he does two things that I think are very interesting. The first is that everybody in Kimmel's staff thought that they were going to be fired. He doesn't fire anybody.
He hangs on to some of the most capable staff officers that served anywhere during the Second World War.
Yes.
His intelligence chief, Edwin Layton, being
yes.
one of the more notable individuals he saves.
Yes, yes. And there's several reasons for this. First of all, it's partly because he knows that they're very capable. And secondly, they're not necessarily responsible for what happened at Pearl Harbor. In some cases, these guys were more aware of the problems than Kimmel was. The second half of this is Kimmel's personality had a lot to do with what happened in Pearl Harbor. And the thing that illustrates the difference between these two officers is that Nimitz arrives in Pearl Harbor, and he's commander-in-chief of the fleet. He moves into a villa on the seaside, and his official flagship is a submarine. He doesn't go to sea.
He takes the oath of office to be Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet, SINCPAC, on
the Grayling,
the deck of a submarine.
Yeah. Now, Kimmel had his headquarters aboard the Pennsylvania. As far as he was concerned, when the war came, he was going to go on the bridge of the Pennsylvania, and he was going to lead the fleet to victory over Japan. The difference, it's pretty clear, I think, that Nimitz understood what the war was going to be like. It wasn't going to be, me standing on the bridge and directing the battle. It's me juggling task forces all across the Pacific Ocean. So in a way, Kimmel is more like Yamamoto. Yamamoto keeps sitting in a battleship when he might have been better off in an elaborate headquarters somewhere with literally, I think Nimitz's headquarters ended up with about 1,500 people. Now, how many people could you get aboard the Pennsylvania to do all that staff work?
A few dozen, and it illustrates the point that Nimitz understood that the most powerful weapon he had at his disposal were radios,
yeah,
in many ways.
Yeah, communications, again, it's his technical background. He had done the battleship, he had commanded a battleship, he had commanded a task force with a carrier, he had done the submarines, he had worked in the personnel department, so he knew everybody. He was perfect for this job, and he was calm. I am amazed. I mean, if you had sent me to Pearl Harbor a week after the Japanese attack, I don't know.
There's oil on the water. There's still fires burning,
yes,
from the attack.
Yeah, and he's like really calm, laid back. I guess what's his name played him twice? Fonda, right? I think it was twice.
Henry Fonda played him several times, yes.
Yeah, several times. And I think he got the man. It's just this, and meanwhile the brain is churning. But
it's a very different set of thoughts.
Yes.
Instead of just lying on the defensive the way Kimmel wanted to, he was starting to think about it. How can I use what little I've got left to get in some sucker punches against the bad guys?
Yeah, and he picked some good people. In many ways, we always want to talk about Coral Sea and Midway, and because, we'll give a nod to the raid on Tokyo. But the raid on Tokyo was the last of a series of raids, some of which did not come off, but some of which were, in their conception, extraordinarily daring. It was the calculated risk thing that he does at Midway when in his instructions to the Spruance. Go there, do some damage. Try not to lose the fleet, but do unto so that the enemy has to react rather than act. There's several things I think that are interesting about him. The three guys that command these things are all black shoe sailors. They're surface warfare experts.
Cruiser and destroyer guys.
Yeah. Spruance, of course, and Fletcher, and Brown, Wilson Brown. They have been working with the carrier guys for a while. Spruance, of course, had been working with Halsey, who was probably the best of the carrier guys, although he deteriorates. I think Halsey's excellence was if he was just by himself with a simple task, and he could really do it well. When things got too big, when he had to command, a whole theater-wide kind of operation, I think he began to lose it. But Spruance had been his cruiser guy, for the first part of the war. So Spruance understood what the airmen were doing. He also introduced the custom of having a chief of staff who was of a different branch than your own, which was something other people had not done. These guys conducted these raiding operations, I think, you know, I mean, Nimitz obviously knew about them, and he allowed them to do it. So he, in fact, I was browsing through the docs and trying to find, you know, some authorization of it. But I haven't yet, you know, his comments.
Oh, it's in the war plans, right up in December and January. You got to dig for them, but they're there. And that's where we're going to take our next step. I mean, we have this man, this very impressive individual, but what's he thinking during the time? What's he doing? And one thing we know today that is paramount in understanding Chester Nimitz is that Nimitz believed in history. He believed in using it, he believed in studying it, and he believed in documenting it. Correct, Al?
Yeah.
And along the way, from the moment he arrives, and in fact the actual document predates his arrival slightly, there is a document called the Gray Book. Talk a little bit about the Gray Book and what it was.
I guess the best way to explain it is that it's not a diary. You don't find much opinion in it. But
it says what happened on that day.
Yeah, it's more like, this is what happened today. This is what was thought. I think that's really important. This is what was thought. Here, I got a page open, right? The view was held for some time that carriers were both north and south of the island. This is a couple of days after Pearl Harbor. It's just a factual statement. It's not, you know, it's your fault, it's my fault, it's somebody else's fault. It's a factual statement. Yes, this view was held. And as you read through it, you get these little gems of stuff. Bottom of page 2, right? Why was it thought that there were carriers both north and south of Hawaii? Because remember, the perception of the attacks is that they're coming from the south or the southwest or the southeast. Because, you know, if you envision in your mind the planes splitting around and then coming over Pearl Harbor in a sort of a loop, turns out that one of the cruisers, which happened to be southwest of Hawaii, sent a message, and a coding error, you know, where they were reporting, you know, aircraft carriers spotted, and was supposed to be no, and the coding error said 2. Now, this is what's going to happen, you know. This is wonderful because it tells us several things, actually. First of all, why they thought they would, you know, but also that clearly at this point in the war there was still some need to develop more efficiency in communications and encoding and whatnot, you know. The Navy is still somewhat on a peacetime sense, even though it's, you know, a couple of days after Pearl Harbor. And you go through...
And you definitely get the sense of this from the Gray Book. Let's now take advantage of Dr. Benson, who's been very patiently waiting for us. You still with us there, Doctor?
Yes, I'm still here.
Now, you're not a historian by trade, although it's hard to imagine you not picking up a certain amount of the feel of this book, The Gray Book, by osmosis. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about when you became involved. What was this thing The Gray Book presented to you as? What, as part of the team, what was the explanation for the value and the qualities of this document?
I think probably one of the overriding factors was its connection to the Naval War College. Why it was even introduced to me in the first place was this strong connection that you and Al are just talking about now regarding analysis of events as they unfold, the mental efforts that go into looking at the situation day to day. This was all part of a process that had been unfolding at the War College for about 30 years, where they were working on building an operational planning process. I think it was first called the Green Hornet, later became an official publication called Sound Military Decision. But in this book, they talked about the importance of the fourth step, which was kind of a high level of abstraction. At the fourth step, that's where you started to review what was happening. You collected records. As Al pointed out, it's not really a diary, but it's a record of the events as they unfolded day to day. Well, this strong connection with the War College gave us the impetus to actually pursue digitizing this document and preserving it. That was the main connection, I think.
For our listeners,
sure,
let's give them some sense of the physical qualities of this. It obviously runs from right at the start of World War II, even actually predating Nimitz's arrival at Pearl Harbor, because there's a fair amount of Kimmel-based material at the very
mm-hmm.
beginning of it.
Yes.
But how many pages, and what are the pages like?
Well, there's 4,030 pages, and they're typewritten on onion skin paper. And they were originally bound in post binders, two post binders. As seven volumes were the running estimate, the daily record that Nimitz's staff was keeping. And the eighth volume is a combination of dispatches and other documents. So it's quite a large set of documents we're dealing with.
And what happened to it when it was closed out at the end of World War II? What initially was the fate of this document?
Well, I can only guess what it was. Maybe Dr. Nofi can add to this, but what we do these days is all of the disposition of those records follows naval records management practices. This was a top secret document, so my guess is that it was archived as classified material in what today we might call a dim archive, which means it's not accessible to most people, but it wasn't totally inaccessible. If you had top security clearance, you would have access to top secret documents that were archived. My familiarity came with it while it was archived at the Naval History and Heritage Command, where it exists now. So it could have gone straight from its existence at Pearl Harbor with the Nimitz's staff. Once the war was over, it could have been moved there through records management into deep archives at the Naval History and Heritage Command.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I was doing the Fleet Problem book, one of the things I noticed was that pre-war naval record keeping was poor. And I could not find a complete set of documents for any one of the 21 fleet exercises, although it was clear what documents were missing from the various, because I could find some sets of types of documents for 1 year and not for the next year. So I think Nimitz's sense of history, remember, first of all, it's a big document, so it's less likely to get lost easily. And it's just likely that, you know, he brought it with him when he moved from Hawaii at the end of the war. You know, much less chance of it getting lost that way.
Interesting. Dr. Benson, what was the you made a reference to accessibility, and prior to this current curation effort that we're going to talk about here after the break, what sort of access would a researcher like Dr. Nofi or myself have if we had wanted to go and sit down with the original Gray Book? What would we have been offered in terms of access?
Well, subsequent to its becoming unclassified in 1972, you could have made arrangements with the director of the Naval History and Heritage Command, assuming they would accommodate you, that you would come to the archives, sit in a reading room, and it wasn't really until about 2009 that a finding aid was written. A finding aid is a document that describes Nimitz's papers that were collected and archived. There's about 77 linear feet. Within that document, it would just generally state what was contained in boxes by some subject heading or name. And there you would see there was these 8 volumes of the Nimitz Gray Book available. So access was pretty limited. In 1984, there was a company called Scholarly Resources that photographed the Gray Book with a 35-millimeter camera and created 35-millimeter microfilm. So starting in 1984, you could have had broader access to it outside of the archives by looking at this microfilm if you wanted to go to a library that held a copy. But the problem with the microfilm was that it was in black and white, and those of you who have seen the Gray Book, either its digital facsimile or the original, you'll notice that pages are different colors, and the color has meaning. So that was missing from the microfilm. It was also a low resolution looking at 35-millimeter film on a small black and white low resolution screen. And you still had the difficulty of intellectual access. How did you get to the information contained in this aside from just reading it one page after the other? Then in 2009, there was another effort to scan this digitally here at the War College. But the problem with that scanning in 2009 was that, again, the resolution was low, so there was a lot of a lot of text wasn't legible. There was a lot of faint handwritten inscriptions written into the margins of the Gray Book that weren't legible. And again, it wasn't searchable. The real accessibility of this document isn't just having access to the object. It's how do you get at what's inside of this document? How do you get the Gray Book to loosen its grip on 4,000 pages of text? So that still remained a problem in 2009. Then,
and we're going to talk about that here in just a minute. We have to take a little break for some network messages. But when we come back, we're going to continue our talk with Dr. Alan Benson and Dr. Al Nofi about Admiral Nimitz and the Gray Book. We'll be back in just a minute. This is Military Monday.
Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Rightstream Radio Network. Tune in to host Daria Ann for Rightstream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. Rightstream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. Rightstream Tuesday with Daria Ann. Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Rightstream Radio Network. Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, tune in to Rightstream Radio Network for Just Believe with author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvis. Lisa interviews experts in the areas of health and wellness, alternative healing, paranormal phenomena, intuitive guidance, and positive living. With her own inimitable down-to-earth style, Lisa makes both guests and callers welcome and appreciated. Just Believe with Lisa Tarvis, Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 Central, here on the Rightstream Radio Network.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And we'll never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends.
I want to be outside playing.
Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.
These are the sounds of someone taking their eyes off the road. Texting while driving is more than distracting. It's dangerous. Do us all a favor. When you're on the road, stay off the phone. A message from CTIA, America's Wireless Companies, and the National Safety Council.
You're listening to the RightStream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at RightStream and hashtag RightStream. Thanks for listening to the RightStream Radio Network.
And we're back on Military Monday talking about Fleet Admiral Chester Nimitz and his gray book. Al Nolfi, are you still with us?
Go ahead.
And Dr. Benson, are you still with us, sir?
Yes, I'm still with you.
Excellent. God, I love it when the technology works. to our listeners, I must confess a little bit of honesty. Al Nolfi has been an acquaintance of mine for many, many years. We came together through a mutual interest in gaming and simulation and have continued that friendship for, good God, at least 20 years. And so be aware that there is more than just a little friendly banter going on here. Dr. Benson, you talked about a couple of false starts in properly documenting the gray book. What was different about this latest effort, which I think everybody is already agreeing is something of an unqualified success? Talk a little bit about what was different about this effort and what made it successful.
Well, one factor certainly is the people who come together at the right time with the right motivations and the right support. We met with the president in March of 2012 of the Naval War College. That was Admiral Christensen at the time. He had an interest in this, and Doug Smith here at the War College, a professor in strategic planning, and Professor John Hattendorf, he's the director of the Naval War College Museum, and he's also the chairman of Maritime History Department. So there was just an alignment of the right people, and I had an interest in digital preservation and managing these kinds of projects. So there was a small amount of money remaining from an earlier attempt. It was about $10,000. And I knew immediately that there wasn't any way for the Naval War College to invest in the kind of equipment really necessary to do high-resolution scanning of a document that large. So what we did differently is we took more of a role of being project managers and understanding the problems of digital preservation and outsourced the actual scanning to a company called the Digital Art Corporation. And we wrote several specifications on meeting certain quality standards. And, of course, they had the high-end equipment that we couldn't afford. And so it was a good, successful way to approach the problem, outsourcing it to another company to do the actual digitization.
Now, you talked earlier about why it was important to be able to see the document not only at appropriate resolution, but also details like the color of the paper, the notes written in the margins, such. Talk a little bit about what is the significance of the color of the sheet of paper it's typed on, and how important are these little notes that are in the margins you talk about?
Well, I think that I'll offer some insight, but I think this is one of an infinite number of questions that are unanswered now and that historians like both of you will be answering in the future as you do a lot of analysis of this 4,000-page manuscript. But it appears on the surface anyway that the first parts of this document are typewritten on white paper, interspersed occasionally with sheets of green. And these include directives and operational messages, things that were originally classified secret that affected the operational situation day to day. Then starting in about May 1942, we start to see pink pages interspersed that they give further information at really high levels of classification that are traveling between the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Ernest King, and some involving Allied forces. Then from January 1945, you start to see these yellow pages marked Nimitz only. Now, the significance of the colors, I think, require a close observation. But anyway, we see these different colors, and I've given you just a basic observation I've seen in my casual looking at the book.
And you talked a little bit about the margin notes. Who was writing these, and what are the significance of them in your mind as an archivist and librarian?
Well, as an archivist, I'm primarily interested in making sure that we develop a really high-resolution, accurate digital facsimile that's true to the original, that all of these notations are seen clearly, and they are in the digital facsimile we created. It would probably be more interesting as to historians and historians of writing what the intent of these inscriptions are. We know that they're created by early readers of the document, possibly even the early creators of the document. Sometimes it looks like they're just corrections in syntax and grammar, which implies maybe that this was done early on in the existence of this document by its own creators and those reading it, maybe even Nimitz and others that were reading these documents daily would make notations or at least sign off that they had read a particular entry. But more extensive inscriptions in the margins, it's hard to say if these are just original markings by researchers in the archives that had early look at this document. It's difficult to say.
I'm looking, for example, right now at page 846 of Volume 1. You're not expected to know what's on that page, but there are just a whole series of fascinating corrections. There's a spelling correction in the opening paragraph that talks about whether or not there's been any radio traffic from the Japanese regarding the defeat at Midway. And in the second paragraph, they're discussing the absence of enemy operations in and around the Indian Ocean. And over on the left side, clearly in pencil, there is a notation regarding a small Japanese force that was operating in the Indian Ocean at that time that's just tantalizing to look at. And it makes you wonder, was this a correction that maybe Layton or one of the intel guys put in to make sure that the record was actually, you know, amended to reflect real-time intelligence or what? I mean, as you say, these are tantalizing little insights.
Yeah. Yes, and we're always concerned with authenticity and maintaining that aspect of these documents. So once it's been digitized, It's frozen in time now, so there won't be any hand inscriptions written into the digital facsimile.
And we'll talk more about the protection of the document here in a couple of minutes. Obviously, what we have here is this very, very impressive scanning effort. But you've done more than just scan this thing. You've also provided some search tools, some reading aids with it that were not there prior to this, correct?
Yes, that's correct. We were really faced with a couple of formidable challenges in this project. One was the digitization and preservation of the gray book. Just because of its size, that was problematic. And because it was hidden away deep in the archives down in Washington, D.C., that was a second logistic problem.
But down there next to the Ark of the Covenant in Maryland, yes.
Yeah. But so that was one problem, just the digitizing and preservation. The second problem was, how do you make this information available to everybody? And I don't mean access to the file, but I mean, how do you get it, this document, to loosen its grip on so much information? So hand in hand with scanning this document at a very high resolution, we also built a full-text searchable index. Now, that captured about 60% of the words. The problem
and it's a huge benefit to people like Al and I, obviously.
Yes, it's what we call an uncorrected OCR scan, OCR standing for optical character recognition. It's uncorrected, meaning that the machine recaptured a lot of text, and it looks like garbage to the computer because of the handwritten inscriptions. There's a lot of tabular formatted information that couldn't be translated into text characters. But we captured about 60% of it that way. The other 40% of the 4,000 pages will only be captured and indexed by hand transcribing the document over time.
So there's a couple of master's candidates who can go and make their bones by going and working on this still.
Yeah, in the meantime, we're also building keyword and subject indexes. That's a labor-intensive process, but you can go through the document looking for particular keywords and building an index manually, helping researchers like Dr. Nofi zero in on particular subjects of interest. But even that takes months of dedicated time. And mentioning the grad students doing the transcription, we originally thought of crowdsourcing the transcription, where
Ooh.
We would mount it on the internet and open it up to the world to come in and start transcribing. And we thought people like yourselves would really dig in and have a lot of fun doing that. But the problem with hand transcription was it was going to create a lot of work for the Naval War College Library in being able to double-check the transcriptions and making sure
yeah,
that...
Yeah, validation of the transcription work.
Yeah, that became an unsurmountable problem in itself. So as it stands right now, we're exploring having professional transcription done on the document to pull out that last 40%.
Mm. Al Nofi, what does
I've
it
just
mean
been
to have these rudimentary tools to finally be able to go after this document and be able to search it as a researcher?
Yeah, well, you know, I've just been toying with the search while I'm listening to you, and it's just wonderful, even with the fact that I can only search, you know, short phrases or single words. And there's like a ton of stuff here. Like I mentioned Wilson Brown as one of the raiding carrier guys in the early part of the war. And I just entered his name in. And there's this wonderful couple of entries. One of them says received, and then there's a message code number from Admiral Brown giving his views as to how the enemy can be held in the New Guinea, northeastern Australia area. Then there's another one about we haven't heard from Admiral Brown, you know, until, and another entry which I had not heard. No report. This is what is this? This is March 11th. March 11th. 1942. No report from Brown, but enemy radio indicates contacts beginning. Right? So they haven't heard from our guys, but we've intercepted the enemy saying we're getting jumped by somebody. This is just wonderful stuff. And as you say, you know, as you get more elaborate search tools available, other stuff will sort of jump out at people. I can imagine that this being available this way is going to require a lot of rewriting, not necessarily of the broad conclusions in a lot of existing serious works on the war, but in the way that things are discussed, you know, how this happened and what was known and what was not known at the time. Because too often, relying on existing sources and whatnot, we lose the mystery. And here we got some mystery here. Where is, in effect, that one message just saying, well, we don't know where Wilson Brown is, but the enemy has kindly provided us with some information that they're being hit.
It makes you wonder what our good friend John Pichel will do in his next book, or certainly in his next posting. Dr. Benson, we talked a little bit on Friday during our warm-up call. You talked a little bit about going and protecting the document, and that it was not just the paper copy that needed preservation, protection, and loving care, but the digital version also requires protection and authenticating. Talk a little bit about that real quick.
Certainly. Well, a vexing property of all digital objects is this difficulty we have of ensuring that they're authentic, that their ongoing authenticity is stable, that it doesn't alter. The files can get corrupted as they get used, and there's such a thing as bit rot. And I should make clear, too, we're not talking about the copy that Al Nofi's looking at, mm-hmm. or the tens of thousands of downloads that have occurred across the Internet. What we're concerned with is the original archival master copy that's extremely high resolution. That copy alone is over a billion bytes in size. That's the copy that we're trying to preserve. Just because the Internet is ubiquitous, the gray book's now ubiquitous, but it's a low-resolution derivative copy. It still looks good, but it's considered a derivative copy. So our challenge is, how do you maintain this single archival quality master copy that we built? So what we've done there is we've created three copies of that and distributed it geographically. That in
when you say distributed geographically, you mean they're on three servers in three separate physical locations?
Yes. But then we're faced with the reality that the life expectancy of hard drives is 3 to 5 years. So part of a digital preservation program is you keep transferring this information from one long-term storage medium to another long-term storage medium, generation after generation. Interestingly, we kind of used paper as a preservation reverse process. We printed two hard copies of the gray book on acid-free paper. To me, that's pretty unproblematic. We know that in a good storage condition, these will last well over two centuries, and we won't have the problem of transferring from one medium to the next.
How do you go and maximize the life of the original paper copy of the document, by the way? I mean, how long can we reasonably expect that entity to survive given current curation technology and procedures?
Well, it will last in the centuries as long as it's stored in the correct environment with humidity and temperature control. So assuming that the Naval War College is still here in two centuries and that the archives has maintained adequate environmental controls, that document should be doing fine in two or three centuries from now. But we still ultimately face this problem that the paper is going to turn to dust one day. So that's the advantage of digitization. As long as we can manage the transferring of that set of 4,030 TIFF images over 1 gigabyte of data, if we can keep moving it from one medium to the next, theoretically we can keep the existence of those bits forever. Whereas the paper, the original paper document will one day be dust, our second copy of the paper will turn to dust, and with each generation of digitizing these paper printouts, of course, the resolution will degrade. So it's really important for us to preserve this archival quality master digital copy.
Al, we've talked about this really wonderful document today, and obviously folks like you and I could spend years of our lives going and picking out bits and nuances and taking off our other places to go and verify them and get the rest of the story. In your mind, as a author and researcher, and very much a peer to people like myself, how do you value this preservation effort, and what do you think of the document as it is presented today?
Oh, this is just marvelous. I mean, this is just a wonderful effort at something that you made a particularly good choice in doing this with this, because this is a fundamental, this is sort of a foundational document for further work in the field. A lot of times we get people preserving stuff that really isn't necessarily that important, you know. But this is just what was thought at the time. I just glanced at the Tokyo raid, and you know, we've had a couple of movies about the Tokyo raid and whatnot, and so we see the tension on the ship and this and that and the other. And I suddenly realized he's got here still no word from Halsey. In fact, the first word they get is the Japanese announcing that they've been attacked. Wonderful
stuff.
Yeah,
there's a broadcast report that's obviously probably NHK announcing the raid.
Yeah, but thinking about his Nimitz doing whatever he's doing, you know, smoking his pipe, or I don't know, did he smoke a pipe? I don't remember now.
I cannot recall what his particular vice was.
Yeah, but and sitting in his headquarters and maybe looking out over the beach, and it's 3 days now, or 4 days, or 5 days since the last communication. My God, the stress on this man. And finally,
he's got
the Japanese
carrier forces out there doing this thing in the North Pacific.
Yeah, and if they get caught, this is a blow equal to Pearl Harbor. You know, if we lose two carriers plus their escorts, that's a significant chunk of what's left of the fleet. The stress is amazing. This is going to just a wonderfully handy for anyone doing work and for refining work on stuff that's already been done.
So much for your recreational read time this summer, Al.
No, I'm working on something else. I'm trying to work on something else.
Dr. Benson, you had as I said, you are not a historian by trade, but you were clearly one of the principals in preserving this really wonderful document that guys like Dr. Nofi and myself are treasuring. Looking back on the effort, and I remember your discussion of this on the night that you presented it to the world, there was a wonderful internet feed. What was your reaction to the reaction to this? Because I was stunned when I heard that the public reaction to this was so great, it crashed your server on the first night?
Yes. As a researcher myself, I'm usually thinking way out in advance, and so mentally I already left this project behind, was already dreaming up the next idea. So I was quite surprised and pulled into the problem of accessibility immediately on the first day. There were two issues we were faced that we didn't predict. One was the far-reaching impact that the public relations efforts resulted in. Apparently, there's people all around the world that had a particular interest in getting access to this formerly top-secret document. Within hours, 4,100 people have tried to download this document. Now, if it had been
a gigabyte of data.
Well, no, the copy that's on the internet that's available for download is only 790 megabytes. But 790 megabytes, pulling that through a pipe on the internet is still almost unmanageable.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened was, it only took 10 or 20 people to try to download it simultaneously, let alone thousands, to crash the local server here in Providence, Rhode Island. Within a day, we had moved it to 12 different servers around the world using the Amazon Cloud server farm. Yeah. That was able to handle the traffic.
How has the traffic been since that time? I mean, you obviously have Al Nopi and myself reading it in real time sitting here. But what has been the public commentary and continued enthusiasm for this document?
Well, I think you and Al Nopi reflect what we've been hearing from people all around the world, that it's like a fascinating window has opened onto that Pacific theater, the battles during World War II. And again, it's not just the fact that you have access to this document. It's that the accessibility to what's inside of it through search capability is really, it's reduced hours and hours of thumbing through thousands of pages to a matter, you can measure it in seconds.
And trekking hundreds of miles or thousands of miles.
Yeah,
or thousands, depending upon if you're a West Coastie or in some foreign country, yes.
Yeah.
And then being able to get into the archives during open hours and meeting a friendly archivist who's willing to pull out several pounds of paper and let you have a look at it.
Yeah,
you know, which,
this is wonderful.
Which probably raises an important preservation point that I've neglected to bring to light, and that's the fact that by creating a digital facsimile, we've helped preserve the original. We've helped preserve it because there's no need for researchers to handle it personally necessarily.
With our literally greasy fingers.
Yes.
Yes, we're protecting it from overuse and even possible misuse.
Yeah.
So it's important to keep the original document alive as long as possible, because that is the one authoritative primary source document.
I just found another gem. I have to say this because it's incredible. Page 857, top of the page. It's a summary report of what we believe the enemy's intentions are. Right, and it says the Boise was sent toward Japan to attack. It's dated September 1st. Of 42. The Boise was sent toward Japan to attack the enemy sampan patrol line. You know, there are no patrol bases settled, but due to a navigational error, the Boise lost two search planes, which unfortunately means they must have lost four men. But then it says one of these planes was found 4 days later by the Japanese, well, actually it says the Japs, and apparently created the impression that a striking force was en route to Japan. At any rate, the enemy hurriedly sent out a force built around three carriers to investigate. Wow! Now, it would be nice to know where they got that information from. Presumably intercepts. But this also is telling us stuff the enemy is doing based on totally bad information as well.
Yeah, you know. And it's that kind of thing that really makes the Gray Book a unique archival tool for people involved in the Pacific War. It's time to we sadly have to wrap up this wonderful interaction, which I have thoroughly enjoyed, and I'm sure our listeners have as well. Dr. Benson, I want to thank you for your excellent work on helping preserve this project, this Gray Book, and I got to go and call you up one of these days and ask you what else you're working on, because if this is the level of quality you folks are working on up there, we've got a lot more to look forward to in the next few years.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to speak with both of you. It was my pleasure.
And
well, thank
Al
you.
Nofi, what can I say? It's always a pleasure to talk to you. I hope I see you in connection.
Well, thank you for the invitation, and I really enjoyed it, and it was good to meet you, Doctor. And yes, I'm hoping to make connections. I'm not sure if I'm going to be asked to speak again, but the trouble is that there's so much going on there that, you know.
It's one of those things where you almost don't want to speak, you just want to listen.
Yeah.
Anyway, gentlemen, I want to thank you both for coming, and we're going to turn you loose so you can go and get on with your day. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And with that, we are coming to the end of today's edition of Military Monday. This was a really special show for me to put together. One, because when I was a boy first starting to go and study history, it was the Great Pacific War that fascinated me. And my heroes, in many ways, were the authors who were going and doing such amazing work at that time in the late 1960s. Walter Lord, who was something of a hero to me as a writer, had just brought out his incredible book, notably named Incredible Victory. And today, of course, we've come a long way from what Walter did and, of course, what he even had to work with. There are great people out there who are using tools like this to go and give us a much clearer idea of what fighting the world's biggest wars were like. And for those who are genuinely interested in looking at the Gray Book, it's very, very simple. Just go and pull up Google or your favorite search engine and type in Nimitz, N-I-M-T-Z, and the word Gray Book, G-R-A-Y-B-O-O-K. Make them two separate words, hit your search, and it'll take you to one of a couple of pages. One will actually show you, and it'll be a Naval War College page, has an archive of the evening's presentation when the book was first rolled out earlier this year. And then, of course, there are direct accesses to the servers where you can download the Adobe PDFs of the actual Gray Book itself. It doesn't take that long if you're on any sort of a broadband connection. And I have to tell you, the quality of this material is truly, truly stunning. If you've never seen a document like this before, I highly recommend you pick it, you go download it, put it in a folder, and just spend a little free time in your casual hours giving it a look. You will be amazed. And that is it for this week. This is John Gresham signing off, and we hope to see you next week at 1 p.m. Eastern for Military Monday.
I took a flat to a pawn shop for a broken guitar. I took a flat to a pawn shop. How much is that guitar? Took a flat to a pawn shop. Got me that guitar. What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? I saw a man on the TV in a mask with a gun. A man on the TV, he had a 10-year-old son. I saw a man on the TV, his son had a gun. And he said that he's coming for me. I never loved a soldier until the walls of war. Never cherished freedom. Freedom never cried. I wrote a song for a dead man to settle my soul. A song for a dead man, and now I'll never grow old. I wrote a song for a dead man. The song to a dead man, to me. I never loved a soldier until there was a war. I thought about tomorrow till my baby hit the floor. I only talk to God when somebody's about to die. Never cherished freedom. Freedom never cried. You can cry for her, die for her, lay down your life for her, kiss and wave goodbye to her. Anything at all. You can cry for her, die for her. There's a baby on the doorstep, wailing away. There's a baby on the doorstep, longing for the day. There's a baby on the doorstep, who gives his life to take. A flag to a pawn shop. Pawn shop. May he forget why he's crying so dear.